Jean, I thank you for those most generous remarks of introduction. And after all the nice things she said, I'm almost afraid to stand up here and speak to you. I look out over the audience, and it amazes me to see everywhere we go familiar faces, and I'm delighted to see you. I hope to make acquaintance with some new faces. It's really a thrill when you can travel from place to place and find brothers and sisters in Christ. And I want to personally thank you for coming to the class this morning. When I realized that you gave up hearing Dub McLeish to come to this class, my heart is touched, seriously. I jokingly told Bill Jackson this morning that when I saw the program and realized that they were moving my speech from afternoon to morning, that in view of the fact that he had me opposite my husband tomorrow, that I really hoped he'd put me opposite of him today so that I wouldn't have so much competition. Of course, he got the best of me on that. Our topic today is challenges to the home. And I don't think any of us have a doubt in our minds about what the home is under attack today. And as Christian women, we have a gigantic challenge, because if the turn back to right does not come from Christian homes, I ask the question, where is it going to come from? Sometimes in talking to young girls, I hear the attitude expressed, well, they expect more of me because I'm a Christian, as though that were not fair. And I answer, they have a right to expect more of us because we're Christians, do they not? That's part of our Christian responsibility. And in all of this clamor that we have heard in recent decades for rights, I'm amazed because we hear not even a whisper for responsibilities. And I maintain that for every right that we have, we also have responsibilities. And this is certainly true of us as Christian women. The home, as we know, is the foundation of any society. You've often heard the statement, as goes the home, so goes the nation. And this is true. Remember the fall of the Roman Empire? It began with the decay of the home. We have maintained for years that America is a Christian nation. Can we really truthfully still say that? As Christian women, we need to be aware of the attacks that are going on against the home. And we need to be aware of where those attacks are coming from if we're going to answer and meet those attacks. I was recently given a little plaque. It's really a little flip chart of many famous sayings regarding the home and family life, and one of them really caught my fancy. It says, home is where life makes up its mind. Now think about that just for a moment. We learn the concepts by which we live in the home, do we not? And if we fail in the home to teach these concepts, then those who are members of that home go out from that particular home, ill-equipped to meet life. And I think we're reaping the result of that in society today. The challenges that we face in the home spill out into the church. There's no way that you can keep problems just in the home. There's no way that you can keep the teaching just in the home. This is the reason that we say the home is the foundation of society. Respect for authority begins in the home. We have done our children no favor. We've really done them a grave disservice when we allow them to be disrespectful in the home. The concept which says, I love my children so much I could not tell them no, is a warped concept of love. And it spills over into the church. And we're seeing in the church today this attitude that I don't understand God's law, therefore I'm not going to abide by it. I'm glad my mother taught me in the home that there are some things you do because it is right and because I say so. I didn't need to always understand why she said it. And we didn't have any lengthy sessions trying to explain to me at 4 years old the intricacies of why she said something. I knew that because my mother said I was to do it, that it was right for me to do it. And I think we need to go back to teaching that attitude toward obedience and respect for authority in the home. Because, as I said before, these concepts spill over into the church. And we're seeing an attitude in the church that's creating many, many problems simply because that concept was not instilled in the home. Well, our topic today on the challenges facing the home and then the challenge of restoring the home to God's favor tomorrow were awfully hard for me to divine. And so I may say some similar things each day, and I offer no apology for that. We want to discuss the challenges to the home under some various aspects. First of all, I think one of the basic challenges against the home is the lax view and attitude that we have today toward marriage. The home begins with marriage. And marriage is God ordained. Remember, God performed the first marriage ceremony, if you want to put it that way. In Genesis, the second chapter, when he allowed Adam, or put Adam, to sleep and took from his side the rib by which he formed Eve. You know, there's a lesson in that that shows God's wisdom. God didn't take a bone from Adam's foot, lest Adam trample on Eve. He didn't take a bone from Adam's head, lest Eve dominate Adam. And doesn't that tell us that the movement today, which really in essence is not clamoring for equality, but is clamoring for superiority, is not God ordained nor God approved. But he took a bone from Adam's side, near his heart. You've probably heard these expressions used in marriage ceremonies. I think they're appropriate. This shows that man and woman are to love each other. Man is to protect the woman. There is to be a mutual relationship there. Woman literally is man's equal. Different, but equal. And if you're yelling for equality, then you want Christianity, because this is where equality is. But this doesn't mean a mixing of the roles, and we're going to talk about that more later. We argue against God's wisdom when we argue against marriage as God intended for it to be. And yet we hear from one of the forefront spokesmen in the women's liberation movement this statement from Gloria Steinem. She says, we must abolish and reform the institution of legal marriage. Why? Now why? Well, simply because this is necessary before women are going to accept the women's liberation philosophy. No right-thinking woman is going to rebel against God's law for marriage, are they? And so you're going to have to convince them that marriage is wrong and that we are oppressed in the institution of marriage. You know, we joke, marriage is an institution, and who wants to be institutionalized? But there's really a serious matter in this attack against the attitude toward marriage. From another one of their publications comes this statement, and I want you to listen closely. Some who innocently were caught up into thinking they supported the ERA movement and all that went with it did not really realize all that went with it. From a document that they have published called The Document, A Declaration of Feminism, and I make no attempt to memorize all this junk, but we do need to know about it. But here's this statement. Marriage has existed for the benefit of man and has been a legally sanctioned method of control over women. The end of the institution of marriage is a necessary condition for the liberation of women. Therefore, it is important for us to encourage women to leave their husbands and not to live individually with them. Now we know that it is the institution of marriage that has failed, and we must work to destroy it, end of quote. Now that's about as plain as I can get, isn't it? The marriage institution, we know, is not what's failed. It's the individuals involved in it that have failed. I am very sympathetic toward those who have an unhappy marriage. In as far as my ability to sympathize, I really can't say fully and truthfully that I sympathize because I've never experienced that. But it must be sad to be in an unhappy marriage. But that doesn't mean that God's plan for marriage is wrong and that that plan is a failure. The participants in marriage don't fail because of a love for obeying God's laws. Somewhere down the line, when a marriage fails, someone has failed to abide fully by God's principles. Because if we both put the other person first, if we both spend our time in following God's pattern, we're going to work at making that marriage successful, and it is a work. You take two people from different backgrounds and merge their lives together, and there is a lot of adjustment, a lot of love required, and a lot of love for God's pattern required. But ladies, it can be done. And we need to get back toward emphasizing to our young people God's law for marriage. Brother Jackson mentioned a while ago in dealing with the talk on antiism that we let a generation go by that didn't realize what this was all about. And I feel we've let a generation go by who do not know the seriousness of God's pattern for marriage. All it takes to create trouble is to let one generation grow up not familiar with God's law. And I can recall being on a program about a decade ago where an elderly lady walked up to me afterwards and she said, "I wish we'd come up with some new topics. I have heard this all of my life." And I replied to her that I'm glad you've heard it all of your life. Some of these haven't. We had many teenage girls in that class. You may know these things, and if you do, and I'm sure that you do, you need to be imparting them to the young girls because they need to learn them too. And we don't want another generation growing up in the church who do not understand the seriousness of the commitment to marriage. The mistreatment of mates violates God's law. And we hear much about wife abuse, and this is wrong, but ladies, husbands can be abused too. And we're reading more and more about the effect of the women's liberation movement and the philosophy on marriages as pertains to husband abuse. It's wrong for either sex to dominate the other. This is not God's plan. God says that husbands are to love their wives and that women are to be submissive and respectful of their husbands, and God's wisdom is supreme. And then coupled with the lax views toward marriage is the flippant attitude that society now has toward divorce. Easy, no-fault divorce ends marriage almost as easily as we used to end courtship. If you and your husband have problems, you just agree that it's nobody's fault and we're going to part, and that's it. And the divorce court will grant you that freedom from that relationship as far as the legal eyes are concerned, but God does not grant that severance so easily. Now, it's bad when we have this attitude, which some experts are even claiming that divorce improves the quality of marriage. There's a Dr. Mary Jo Bain who has made this statement, and of course, I need not tell you that she is of the women's liberation philosophy. And it's bad when we have this relationship and this attitude taught out in the world. But what alarms me even more is the attitude that we have in the church currently, which says, in essence, that the guilty party has just as much right to remarry as the innocent party. And I'm even hearing some now say that, who am I to judge who's guilty and who's innocent? Who am I to say that a couple must stay together? In other words, if two people courting have a spat, let them break up. And that's in essence what we're saying about marriage. We need to get back to teaching that when there are problems that arise, it means you have to work that much harder to work out those problems. Where did we get the idea that we can give up on marriage so easily? God didn't say this. And if the guilty party can marry as much with God's approval as the innocent party, pray tell me, why did inspiration bother to put Matthew 19:9 in the Bible? That passage says, whosoever. And whosoever means you and it means me. It means everyone. Where did men get the idea that this whosoever means just those who are Christians? Where did we get the idea that God's law for marriage and divorce came under Christianity only? Marriage was a part of God's plan from the very beginning of time. It didn't enter into the picture under marriage. And where did we get the idea that Christians are the only ones that are amenable to God's law on marriage and divorce? Ladies, somewhere down the line, we're failing to teach God's law on the home. And this is one of the biggest challenges that we have. Divorce statistics are alarming. No longer can we really say that if a Christian marries a Christian, he has good marriage insurance. Because of these lax teachings that we're having come out of some of our own people. There are some statistics on marriage and divorce that have recently been published that I find most alarming. And I'd like to share some of these with you. In a recent paper that came out, well, it's not all that recent, but it's not all that old either. But in the early 80s, either 81, 82 or 83, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch were these statistics. In 1901, 750,000 new marriages were reported. In that same year, 50,000 to 60,000 marriages, divorces rather, were also reported. Now that's a ratio, 750,000 now marriages to 55,000 to 60,000 divorces. That was in 1901. By 1971, there were 2 million new marriages reported, 700,000 divorces. By 1980, it was 2,413,000 new marriages, but 1,182,000 divorces. Don't you see how that's jumped up? Easy divorce has increased the statistics. In the 1982 People column in the Commercial Appeal, they reported 25 million marriages. And for the first time, they said the divorce rate was down 3%. But that statistic is not really that encouraging because that rate is not necessarily holding. The divorce rate, even among Christians, is becoming more and more alarming. Here are some further statistics. We have in the United States more and more marriages that are being broken up because of alcoholism. What's behind all of this? Well, I've been called a pessimist and alarmist for reading this statement, but if you have time sometime and want some sober reading, get the book called The Naked Communist by Cleon Skousen. I hope I'm saying his name right. S-K-O-U-S-E-N. One of the things that he lists in this is the goals of the Communist Party. And one of their goals is, quote, discredit the family as an institution, encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. And when I read those words, in my mind's eye, I could see Khrushchev at the United Nations with his shoe banging on the table saying, we will bury you and we will not fire a shot. I say they are becoming more successful all the time. And remember, all that it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to sit back and do nothing. For years and years, we've heard about the silent majority. And I still have to be optimistic enough, ladies, to believe that this loud clamor that we've heard from such as the Women's Liberation Movement is in the minority. They've just been more vocal than we have. And it's time the silent majority ceased to be silent. It's time we spoke up and began teaching what the Bible teaches on these things. Add to the lax view on marriage and the flippant attitude toward divorce the warped view that we have of marriage. There was a time when we didn't have to define who could be married. And yet today this is not true. And today the women's liberation movement maintains that marriage is a bondage to women. Did you ladies who are married know that you were in bondage? They say, and here's another quote, that the greatest oppression of women is that women must marry and that they get pregnant and men do not. You know, I have thought for years and used this when we were fighting the ERA. And by the way, that fight's not over yet. But when it was at its highlight and they were clamoring for equality, I issued the challenge to one of the meetings of women's liberation that when you can get so equal that the women can beget and the men can give birth, then I may talk to you about your movement. There was a little lady in Ripley, Mississippi, who made a statement one time that she was interviewed on her 75th wedding anniversary. And a commercial appeal reporter called and asked her for some statements about her viewpoint on women's liberation. And I thought her answer was a classic. She said there, God made women to do some things and men to do other things, and they have no business trying to get it all confused. Now, can you say it better? I couldn't say it any more plain than that. Women are not in bondage. But their further statement goes on to say that the second drudgery of women is that they have to take care of these babies after they're born. And then I remember reading in Ann Landers the statement that if you had it to do over again, would you have children? And the 80% or above who said no. And I think of the joy and pleasure that our children have brought to us, and I can't imagine a mother making that statement about her children. But this is the philosophy that women's liberation has placed upon us today, and we think we're not listening to any of it, ladies. But some of it is having more effect even upon Christian women than we would like to admit. We are told that women deserve a career that's challenging. And they're also told that homemaking is a waste of talent. It's very demeaning. After all, anyone can cook and take care of children. But ladies, can just anyone train your children as God would have them trained? I made lots of mistakes, and I'm sure you as a mother would say the same thing. We're human. If we didn't make mistakes, we'd be a deity. And yet, with all of those mistakes, I would not have wanted to entrust my children's training to anyone else, because I don't believe they would have trained them like I wanted them trained. And if we teach our children God's law, and if we train them with love, and they know they're loved, those mistakes are going to be minimized. I never wanted our children to think we were perfect and couldn't make mistakes. That's frightening. Don't put yourself up on a pedestal like that. Admit when you're wrong. That teaches them that you can be wrong and you can be forgiven. And this gives them courage when they make mistakes to know that they can pick up the pieces and go on. But I maintain that when we're talking about a career for women, we have that career, and it's God-given. Motherhood is the greatest career and the greatest challenge that God could conceive for woman. In our hands, God has placed the ability to create change, either for good or for bad. The choice is up to us. And I maintain that in the hands of Christian women is the ability to answer the problems facing the home, the church, and society. And let me tell you how. In every speech that I give on the home, I issue this challenge, and I'm dead serious about it. If every woman in this class determined that she was going to live as God would have her live as a Christian, to be the kind of mother who would instill into her children's hearts that same desire and determination to the point that they too were successful, and that they too instilled it in their children, and so on down the line, how long do you think it would be before we'd have a different society, a different attitude in the church, and a different nation? We have the ability to give that answer. And then you think of all the ones who somewhere down in the line have broken the chain of faithfulness to that challenge. And you can think of numerous people in every community that you go that are no longer of use to God's kingdom because somewhere down the line something else became more important to them. In our hands is the ability to do God's will and to bring about marvelous changes. You know, Lois and Eunice are mentioned in the Bible because they passed on their unfeigned faith to Timothy. They're not commended by inspiration for being successful career businesswomen. And I'd much rather have inspiration stamp of approval anytime. We talk about the frustrations in the home. And I want to tell you frankly, I have been in both shoes. Before and after our children, I've been in the business world. And I never faced a frustration in the home that compares with the frustration that you can face out in the business world. If you want freedom from frustrations, you don't want life. Because nowhere this side of heaven are you going to find that kind of utopia. Added to these challenges is a challenge of a concerted effort to reshape society's thinking about the home. The National Organization for Women, known as NOW, is leading the march to reshape our thinking. They're wanting to even change the language. They call our language sexist language. And they've gotten to be the point of ridiculous. No longer do they want to be called the spokesman. Gloria Steinem would have had a fit if she'd heard me talk about her being the spokesman for the women's liberation movement. But I refuse to change my language. Now they want to be called the spokesperson. And you know, our teenage son made an observation that I think is very appropriate here. Person ends with S-O-N, and when I went to school, S-O-N was just as much male term as M-A-N's. And so we haven't really eliminated that. You know, from every language that I am familiar with, which is not very many, but there is a close connection in the word used for woman and man. And when you say woman, you have to say man. What's wrong with that? God meant for us to have a close connection. And so we've become to the point of being ridiculous. They've even clambered to the point that they had legislation in the San Francisco City Council trying to change the name of the cover over your sewage on the street from manhole to personhole. So when you drive down the street, you watch those person holes. Child development centers are a big thing with those who want to change the view of the home unit in society. Now, I said child development centers. That's not the same thing as child care centers. There's a vast difference. In this proposed child development center, you would have a staff mainly of those with a very liberated philosophy. I like to say they are so open-minded they have holes in their thinking. And their goal in these centers would be to have that child away from your influence during those early formative years for most of the hours of the day to fill those little minds full of their philosophy. This is one of the things that I caution women when they work and leave their children in care. And you young mothers, listen carefully. You think you have competent babysitters, but do you? Probably you ladies here today are not guilty of this, but you passed the word. We had an article in our paper from Memphis recently that told of this true incident, and I'd like to think it's isolated, but I'm afraid from what we read that it's not. This lady had taken her little child to the pediatrician for a regular checkup, and while she was there, there was a young lady there with a baby. She assumed was her own, but she later learned was not. The child began crying, and the doctor had been called out on an emergency and was a little late, and so they had a little lengthy wait there. And the child continued to cry, and so the lady took a bottle out and popped the baby down on a cold, hard floor and stuck the bottle in his mouth. And she said it was obvious the milk was sour. And she said it wasn't long until it became obvious that the baby needed diaper change. And so this mother just couldn't stand it any longer, and she said something to the lady. When with that, the lady jerks the child up by the arm, pulls it up, slings it across the shoulder, and says some very uncomplimentary statements to the effect that she was taking the child back to her care center. She didn't have any more time to waste on it. Now, the parents of that child were paying hard-earned money for that child's care. And this goes back to my concept, ladies, that there are some things money can't buy. And you'd best live on a lower income and do without a lot of those things that you think you want and stay at home and take care of your children. If you really need those things, there'll be a way for you to get them later. Your children will grow up too fast. And don't take the dangerous chance of leaving your children in that kind of care. Television has done much to change the attitude of the concept on how society should view the home. Here again we have a statement from Gloria Steinem. And any time you see that name, you have trouble. She makes the statement that by the year 2000, we will, I hope, raise our children to believe in human potential and not God. That's the concept that they want to teach in these child development centers. No longer does television claim that they give us what we want. They're now openly admitting that they're giving us what they want us to have to reshape our thinking about society. And this statement is documented in the Wildman reports, and I don't know if you're familiar with his reports or not. I don't agree with his religious philosophy, but he has done a lot of good in his cleanup television campaign. This is not the same one as came out of the Joelton Church of Christ with John Hurt. Don Wildman is from Tupelo, Mississippi. He is a Methodist minister, but he is fighting hard to get rid of some of the things that are on television. And he has a documented newsletter that comes out with some interviews in this particular case that he had with some of the producers of our television programs. Feeling that we were not getting much done by our boycott of buying or in going to the television stations, he decided to go to the producers themselves and see if he couldn't do something about cleaning up television programs. And the producers openly admitted that they were not interested in really what society wanted. They were interested in giving them what they wanted them to have. And they're wanting to reshape our thinking. Have you noticed on the television programs how the single or the divorced parent is glorified? That's a subtle way of telling us that marriage is not all that important. And don't you misunderstand the effect that that has upon the thinking of the young children who sit glued to the television sets. They are picturing the husband or the father as a very milquetoast, weak-kneed, mamby-pamby sort of character who is so inept and klutzy that he has to have a woman to tell him what to do. Now, we said it was wrong for a woman to be put down. Is it not just as wrong for us to put down the husband and his role and his place that God has given to him? I maintain that it is. And I maintain that when this is accomplished, if we allow it to be accomplished, that we're going to pay more dearly than the men. Already, marriages are in trouble because of the switch that has been attempted in roles. The house husband is pictured on television as being the thing of tomorrow. Marriage itself is treated as outmoded, and commitment in marriage is a dirty word on television. Have you noticed? After all, what else in the world is that little piece of paper worth anyway? And so we have approval on television of all kinds of deviated relationships, and they're flaunted as being glamorous and glorified. If you want to be on Phil Donahue's show, just portray yourself as some kind of sex deviant, and it's almost assured that you'll make it. When I had back surgery 2 or 3 years ago, and I couldn't do anything else much but lay around and pamper myself, I watched his show a few days, and it was so sickening that I just couldn't watch it any longer. And yet we need to be aware of what's being put out on television, do we not? But the glorification that he gave to these homosexual lesbian marriages almost made them appear to be sacred. And yet the Bible still says that this is wrong. We've gotten away from using sin. We call it everything but sin. But the Bible still says it's sin. And you know, there's a little thing about that word sin that's always interested me. What's the middle letter of sin? There's no way that we can sin unless we're involved. I can't sin unless I'm involved in that sin. And I'm right in the middle of every sin that's going to be on my account. You may have to answer for the influence that you hold over me, but you can't make me sin until I give in to sin. Now, people don't like to hear that, but it's true. I recall a young mother whose child was in a prison in Mississippi, and oh, she would become very angry when she'd hear me make that statement, because her contention was that people made her son commit that robbery, but they couldn't have made him until he finally gave in. I don't care how much influence is made against you to cause you to sin. You're the one that finally decides if you're going to give in to that influence or not. And even if it costs you your life, you're not going to be held accountable for that sin until you give in to committing that sin. And this is true of these illicit relationships. We hear a lot about the homosexual and the lesbians today, and yet the live-in relationship is just as wrong in God's eyes, and it's glamorized. And really, if I were going to be in the frame of mind to take part in the new philosophy against the home and marriage, I think I would rather be involved in the live-in relationship than to have to go through all the expense of all these divorces. You know, this is really an easier way to get out of it, and you don't have all this expense and all this argument over who gets what unless you happen to be one of those who wants to charge a palimony suit. Maybe that will stop some of the live-in relationship. And then we wonder why our young people who grow up in this kind of a home, atmosphere, have emotional problems and turn to drugs and what else. There's no way that you can have stability emotionally and grow up in an atmosphere like this. And until we get away from this concept of breaking down the respect for the home, we're not going to solve any of these problems. Well, what does God say about all this? Well, God's book still says that a man and a woman marry, and that it's to be for life. Romans, the 7th chapter. Used to, when we talk about the home, we didn't have to emphasize that it was the man and the woman who married. But now we do, thanks to the current philosophy. God's book still says that man's to be the head of the home and woman's to be the homemaker. And ladies, in the 2nd chapter of Titus, when it speaks about keepers of the home, that literally means managers of the home. And that injunction is addressed to women and not to men. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that there are situations where the wife must work or where the husband needs to help in the home. But love dictates that this help be given willingly and cheerfully, but it is that help. And that's the key word. It's not to dominate or control the other person's role. It's to help. I grew up in a home with a widowed mother. And I know there are instances when the mother has to work to take care of the children. But that's not the ideal, and she would be the first one to tell you that. And if there was one lesson that she tried to stress with her daughters and her sons, that was it. That when you accept the responsibility of home and family, you accept that responsibility as God would have you be. And don't you shove those children out for somebody else to rear and take care of. And I'm grateful that she taught that lesson. When we have the home effect of drugs, we know that the effect is not yet fully realized. The proverbial bottom line of that is yet to come. And yet I'm alarmed when I see the usage of drugs that we have in our society today. You know, when we first started talking about drugs, we had a lot of people behind the movement of condemning our young people for the use of drugs, and that was what they should have done. But then when the medical society began talking about alcohol as being a drug also, we noticed a severe backing off of condemning drugs. Rather than give up our sin, we decided that theirs wasn't quite so bad. And now we may not have quite as much of the hard drugs in some areas, but we have more and more of the problem with alcoholism. Listen to this alarming statistic. A recent study done by the Xerox Corporation revealed that 25% of fourth grade students in the United States say they feel peer pressure by their friends to try drugs and alcohol. Fourth grade students. By the time they reach the seventh grade, 60% feel the pressure to try alcohol and 50% feel pressure to try marijuana. Now that's frightening. We used to think it was just in our high schools. It's down in our grammar schools now. And then there are these statistics, and because of lack of time, we won't be able to read all of them, but these particular statistics are in the article in the book. 36 million Americans are harmed directly or indirectly because of alcoholism or problem drinking. 9 million chronic alcoholics or problem drinkers exist in America today. 200,000 new cases of alcoholism occur every year. 28,400 of the 50,000 killed in traffic accidents each year have blood alcohol at the time of the accident. 11,000 death certificates annually list alcoholism or alcohol-related causes. 21,700,000 are the latest, $21,700,000 are the latest annual expenditures by Americans for alcoholic beverages. And yet there are $15 billion of alcohol, of economic drain because of damage done from alcoholism. This is just because of the loss of work time, the health and welfare costs. This is nothing about the law enforcement half of it. And yet we're told by those who want to sell alcoholism and legalize it that this will bring economy up in our societies. They don't give you the figures that it costs to enforce alcoholism. When I was first married, I worked for the lawyer in the Tennessee Department of Safety in Nashville, and as such had access to a lot of records as well as photographs of accidents. And let me tell you what, if you want something that'll make you sick at your stomach, you go ask to see the alcohol accident file records. And yet we have those who among the church will defend social drinking, even some so-called elders. It's become a problem in our Christian schools as well as our public schools, because in our Christian schools we have children from lax Christian homes, and I'm using that term loosely, as well as from public homes. There are a lot of threats that are facing the home today, and we have the challenge of facing these big challenges against the stability of American homes. I had a lot more that I'd like to say, but I hear the men already out, and my husband just loves for me to go over what the men do. And so we'll put a period here today, and we'll talk more about some of the solutions. Let me just close by saying that the family of today, if we're not careful, is going to become an endangered species. And we need to work hard toward family togetherness. And just as a little extra thought thrown in, if I had no other objection to the separate worship services that are being practiced in some of our congregations, this would be enough for me to object to the divided assembly. Where is the togetherness of the family who does not worship together? There's something beautiful about seeing a family together at a worship service, and there's something unifying in that relationship. And let's get back to the basics. Thank you so much.